Persigo Press presents the Henry Rios Mysteries podcast. Hello, this is Michael Nava, author of a series of crime novels featuring Henry Rios, a gay Mexican-American criminal defense lawyer, and the producer of this podcast. Today we present Lay Your Sleeping Head, the first novel in the series. Lay Your Sleeping Head opens in the summer of 1982 in the fictional town of Linden, California, 30 miles south of San Francisco. Linden is the home of the prestigious university of the same name, founded in the 19th century by railroad tycoon Grover Linden. Henry Rios is a public defender, born and raised in a small town in California's Central Valley and from a working-class Mexican-American family. He is a graduate of Linden University and its top-ranked law school. In 1982, there is no internet. People smoke in bars and on airplanes. Most gay men are closeted, and no one has heard of AIDS. It's an America where 83% of the people identify as white, 85% as Christian, and 83% say that homosexuality is morally wrong. Ronald Wilson Reagan, who once declared that trees cause more pollution than automobiles, is the president of the United States. In this episode, Rios uncovers evidence that supports his belief that Hugh Parris's drug overdose was not accidental.
You awake?
Yeah.
Scoot over. I'm on the wet spot.
The whole bed's a wet spot. Come here. I know you're weird about this because of our Hugh connection.
I don't know how I feel about that. But I know I like you. Do you feel weird about it?
When you first came to my condo, I was expecting someone shady because I figured that's the kind of guy Hugh would attract. But you're the opposite of shady. It was hard for me to put you and Hugh together, but I could see you and me.
Hugh told me once I was a man with a lonely boy inside of him, waiting for the kiss that would end my loneliness. Until he said that, I didn't realize it was true. Much less that he was the one I'd been waiting for. I think he was just as surprised that I was the one he was waiting for.
Then I guess it's lucky you found each other.
I'm not sure. I'm gonna tell you something that I've only recently been able to admit to myself. Hugh's loneliness was different and deeper than mine. It was a void that only drugs had ever filled. I don't know that I would have ever been enough for him. I'm not sure that he eventually would have ended up somewhere else with a different needle in his arm. I think that's what drives me to want to find out what really happened to him that night.
What do you mean?
To have been in love for the first time in my life. And to have known at the same time that love wasn't enough.
It can be, with the right person.
When you're done in there, there's a police detective named Terry here to see you.
Tell her I'll be right out.
Sorry to bother you so early, Henry. I didn't know you'd have company.
I guess you two have met.
We have. My turn to hit the shower? Pleasure meeting you, Terry.
Same here. Nice guy, Henry. Seems like a keeper.
I'll record your vote.
I got your call yesterday telling me you had news. I've got information about Christina's death for you. You go first.
The papers that were stolen from my apartment ended up with a lawyer at the firm that represents Judge Parris. The lawyer's name is Aaron Gold. You might want to ask him how he got them.
How do you know this?
He's... was a friend. We went to law school together. When I told him I was involved with Hugh, he gave me those letters that Hugh had written to his grandfather I told you about.
What? Why?
He thought he was doing me a favor by warning me away from Hugh.
And now you're sicking the cops on him? Remind me not to get on your bad side.
He knows what happened to Hugh. I gave him the chance to come clean, and he gave me the brush off.
Do you have proof that this lawyer sent the guys who broke into your apartment?
That's what you need to ask him about.
As far as the department's concerned, Hugh's case is closed. I can't just walk into some lawyer's office and start questioning him without something more solid than your word that he told you he saw the papers.
You can, if you're investigating the break-in.
I'm a homicide detective. Burglary is another department. I'm not your private investigator, and I'm not here to settle your scores with some guy you had a falling out with.
You think I'm lying about what Gold told me?
No, but without some concrete evidence that someone, somewhere in all this mess, committed an actual crime, this is starting to look less like an investigation than your personal obsession.
You had your own suspicions about Hugh's death.
I still do. But that's all they are. Suspicions. Conjectures. I have other cases, and if something doesn't shake loose soon on this one, I'm going to have to...
Give me a little more time. I'll bring you something. You said you had something about Christina and Jeremy's accident?
I got you the CHP reports and the transcript from the inquest.
There was an inquest? You didn't have that.
It was sealed, and you didn't get it from me.
Thanks, Terry. I know you're putting yourself on the line for me, and I'm grateful. Give me a few more days, and I'll bring you the proof you need to reopen the case.
I hope so, Henry. This guy, Grant, he's a catch. Maybe you should think about dropping all this and moving on. Hey, I'll talk to you later.
What are you reading?
The inquest report on Christina and Jeremy Paris.
Anything jump out at you?
It's strange there was an inquest at all. They're usually only held when there's some question about the cause of death. But there's no mystery about what killed the Parises. It's also weird that the inquest was conducted here in Santa Clara County when the accident was 200 miles away in Nevada County. And why was it sealed?
Well, the Parises live here, so the inquest was here. And I imagine they got it sealed to protect their privacy. Can I see? God, what an awful way to go. At least they died together.
What did you say?
The hearing officer's findings say, I conclude as a matter of law that the deaths of Christina Paris and Jeremy Paris occurred simultaneously.
That's not right. According to the cops, Christina was dead when they arrived, but Jeremy was still alive. The paramedics tried to revive him. Hey, didn't you find some marked passages about simultaneous death in Hugh's copy of Professor Howard's casebook on trust and estates?
Yeah. Now, where did I leave it? Oh, it's on your desk. I'll grab it. Right. Here it is, marked in yellow highlighter. The doctrine of simultaneous death. Now, let's see. It's based on the principle that dead people can't inherit from living ones. Makes sense. Where would they spend it?
What does it say?
Give me a minute. Okay. I get it. The doctrine addresses the situation where two people die exactly at the same moment, and one of them is the beneficiary in the will of the other person. Professor Howard says, in such a circumstance, the law presumes that the beneficiary predeceased the testator, and the gift is void and therefore reverts to the testator's estate to be distributed in accordance with the rest of the testamentary scheme. Translation? Because dead people can't inherit, when two people die at the same instant, the law pretends the person who stood to inherit died first.
I get it now. That's what Hugh was talking about.
Okay, what are you talking about?
Christina's will left everything to her sons, Jeremy and Nicholas, and nothing to the judge. Jeremy left his estate to Hugh. If Christina and Jeremy died simultaneously, then Jeremy could not have inherited from her, and Hugh wouldn't have inherited from Jeremy.
And her entire estate would have all gone to Nick.
Who is insane and probably under the care of a conservator. Three guesses who that might be.
Judge Paris.
Who else was left to take charge? The judge took control of his wife's estate by getting himself appointed Nick's conservator after he arranged for the deaths of Christina and Jeremy. That's what he was trying to prove. But he didn't have the inquest report because someone got it sealed. Again, three guesses who did that.
The judge. Wait. Professor Howard says that simultaneous death is only rebuttable presumption. That means if there was evidence that Jeremy survived his mother even by a few minutes, that would have been enough for his estate to have inherited half of her estate.
And Jeremy's estate would have gone to Hugh. Do you have any idea of how much Christina was worth? You know, from the rich people's gossip mill?
Hundreds of millions. And half of it would have gone to Hugh through Jeremy's estate. If the police report said Jeremy was still alive when the paramedics arrived, why didn't that come out at the inquest? I mean, if it was an evidentiary hearing, right? I mean, didn't the cops or the paramedics testify?
There's no reporter's transcript of the hearing, not even a list of witnesses. There's nothing but the commissioner's findings.
Oh, Henry, listen to this. It's one of the hypotheticals that Professor Howard uses to explain the doctrine. Quote, a woman of great wealth leaves her entire estate to her two sons, one of whom is killed in the same automobile accident that takes her life. An inquest, conducted without the testimony of witnesses present at the accident, determines as a matter of law that the deaths were simultaneous. Could this finding be challenged? On what basis?
He's describing this inquest.
How could he have known?
I'm going to find him and ask him.
Is he still teaching?
I don't know, but it's easy enough to check with the school. Are you still willing to help me?
Are you kidding? This is a lot more exciting than depositions and discovery compliance. What do you want me to do?
Can you get copies of the wills and confirm that Judge Paris is Nick's conservator? Oh, and find whatever you can about who conducted this rigged inquest. Who was the hearing officer in charge of it?
You think the judge got the inquest moved from Nevada County because he had more pull with the local judiciary down here?
He needed that finding of simultaneous death. I wouldn't be surprised if whoever ran it was in his pocket.
Assume that's all true, Henry. It still doesn't prove the judge was responsible for the deaths of his wife and son. He could have taken advantage of the accident.
If it is true, it at least takes us out of speculation and gives us circumstantial evidence that he was behind their deaths. This may not be the smoking gun Hugh was looking for, but I'm damn sure that one exists, and I'm gonna find it.
Yes, can I help you?
Hello, I'd like to see Professor Howard.
Is he expecting you?
I got this address from the law school, but they didn't have a phone number for him, so I couldn't call. Look, my name is Henry Rios. I was a student of his. I wanted to consult him on a legal issue.
Professor Howard is very sick. That's why we unlisted his phone number. We can't have people bothering him.
Will you ask him if he'll see me? I won't take up much of his time.
Wait here.
He left me at the doorway while he disappeared down the long hall. On the walls of the hallway were framed photographs of professional gatherings, dusty plaques, and certificates honoring him for this or that, but not a single personal photograph.
He will see you, but only for a few minutes. I don't want you to tire him out.
Can you tell me what's wrong with him?
Everything. Follow me. Professor, here's your visitor.
You see that cigar in the ashtray over there? Light it for me, will you?
Professor, I'm not sure you should be smoking while you're hooked up to an oxygen tank.
I'm not going to smoke, son. I just want the fragrance, an old man's incense. Oh, there you go. Oh, Oh, delicious. So, who are you?
My name is Henry Rios. I took your class in trust and estates.
What year was that?
71.
I'd already been teaching for 30 years by then. So forgive me if I don't remember you. My minder said you had a legal issue for me. You're a probate lawyer?
A criminal defense.
Are you sure you're in the right place, son?
I'm pretty sure, Professor. My question is about a hypothetical you posed in the discussion of the doctrine of simultaneous death in your casebook. The one involving the rich woman who dies with her son in a car crash. You based that on Christina Perez's death, didn't you?
Who sent you?
No one sent me, sir. I was friends with her grandson, Hugh. Hugh believed that the car crash was engineered by Judge Perez to get control of his wife's money. But before he could prove it, Hugh was killed. I think the judge was behind that too, but I need evidence. Then I read your hypo. You know something, don't you?
It's Henry, isn't it? I'm an old man, Henry, and I know too much on one hand and not enough on the other. I know people do dreadful things, but I don't know why. I'll tell you about Christina Perez if you can solve my hypo.
In your hypo, the coroner finds as a matter of law that the woman and her son died simultaneously. You asked if the finding could be set aside and how that could be done. Time of death is a question of fact, not law. So unless the coroner can back up that finding with evidence, the finding is an error. I guess you'd bring a motion to set it aside.
Very good, Henry. If the finding was unsupported by evidence, you would move to set it aside and ask that a second inquest be convened, where the time of death would have to be proved by the testimony of the witnesses who are actually there.
Is that what you did, Professor? Did you try to set aside the simultaneous death finding in the Perez inquest?
Yes, but my motion was dismissed on the grounds that I had no standing to challenge the finding, because I was not a beneficiary at either Christina's or Jeremy's wills. And Bob Perez got away with murder.
Do you know for a fact that he had his wife and son killed?
He was in court the day my motion was dismissed. He came up to me afterwards and said, "Nice try, Johnny. I'm sure Christina appreciated it." That's all. But by then, I had known Bob for almost 40 years. And from how he said it, from the look in his eyes and everything I knew about that marriage, it was as good as a confession that he killed him.
Is he that evil?
Oh, my boy, you can't imagine.
How did you know the Perez's so well?
Bob and I were both hired as junior members of the law faculty just before the war. The Second World War, I mean. There was a splendid party given by Christina's father, Jeremiah, to celebrate his 25th year as president of the university. His wife was completely incapacitated by then, so Christina acted as his hostess. Bob and I were both quite taken by her, but I considered myself far too lowly even to ask her for a dance. Bob didn't have my inhibitions. He danced with her and chatted up the old man, and the next thing I knew, he was seriously courting her. Well, Bob was handsome and charming when it suited him. He was also ambitious enough for 10 men. Courted her father as much as he did her. Later, she told me her father wanted the marriage more than she did. Oh, but in those days, girls did what their fathers told them to do. The war came and we were both drafted. I was rejected. Flat feet of all things. But Bob, oh, Bob enlisted in the Marines. Before he left, he and Christina became engaged, again on her father's orders. It was during the war that she and I became friends. There were so few other young men around. I fell in love with her. I think she felt the same, though, of course, because she was engaged, she would never have admitted it. Maybe secretly she sometimes hoped, as I did, that Bob would not return from the war. But he did. He came back a war hero. and they were married. But she and I remained friends to the end of her life.
Tell me about the end of her life, Professor.
After they were married, Bob revealed his true nature. He was, and is, someone who takes pleasure in humiliating and degrading other people. I believe sadist is the clinical term. Bob put her through hell. But he hid that part of his character from her father and made himself indispensable to the old man, whose own son, John, was a great disappointment to him. Christina had nowhere to turn, and eventually she resigned herself to the marriage.
But she was on her way to obtain a divorce when she died.
Yes, something happened. Something terrible that she would never reveal to me, but which involved Bob and... Wait. You said you were friends with her grandson. What was his name?
Hugh. Hugh Paris.
Ah, yes, Hugh. Nick's son. He went to live with his grandparents after Nick was hospitalized. It was shortly after that that Christina came to me and told me she was going to divorce Bob, but first she wanted me to revise her will. She wanted to cut Bob out completely.
And this had something to do with Nick and the judge?
So I gathered. But all she would say is that she would not have Bob poison another generation. In any case, I drafted a new will that froze Bob out. Then she made plans to divorce him.
Why Nevada? Couldn't she have divorced him here?
This was before California adopted no-fault divorce. Christina would have had to publicly reveal her reasons for wanting the divorce. Bob could have contested it. There would have been a trial, a scandal, and she didn't want that. Nevada was already a no-fault state. Divorces were fast and discreet and, of course, legally binding in California.
What happened?
Bob and Jeremy were quarreling, and Jeremy told him about the divorce. Taunted him with it. Stupid boy. I got a panicked call from her, and I told her to make tracks for Nevada as soon as she could. That was Tuesday. She and Jeremy left on Friday, and you know what happened after that.
Did you consider going to the police?
With what, my boy? Conjecture? There was no evidence of foul play.
No direct evidence. But with what you've told me and the evidence Hugh gathered before he died, I could build a strong circumstantial case that the judge was behind the car accident, assuming you're willing to testify.
If you're planning on putting me on the witness stand, you better hurry it along, son. I'm dying. Hugh, the grandson, did he ever tell you what happened between him and Bob that so horrified and incensed Christina?
When Hugh was 10 years old, Judge Paris raped him. The abuse went on for years.
That's abominable.
Professor, why did you put that hypothetical in your casebook?
Do you remember footnote 4 in United States versus Caroline Products? The one that suggests courts should pay closer attention to laws that discriminate against minorities?
Of course. It's the foundation of modern equal protection law.
But it's only a footnote in a case that has nothing to do with racial discrimination. A few throwaway lines that led to a revolution in civil rights law. That hypo was my footnote 4. The only way I had to attack the injustice of the situation. I put it there and hoped that someday someone would discover it and grasp its importance. You have. Thank you.
You've been listening to Lay Your Sleeping Head, a Henry Rios mystery. If you enjoyed this podcast, please spread the word on social media. We depend upon your support to keep this series going. For updates and behind-the-scene extras, visit us at our Facebook page, The Henry Rios Mysteries, or at michaelnavawriter.com under the podcast tab. We'd also love to hear from you. Message us on Facebook or email us at persigopress@gmail.com. That's persigopress@gmail.com. This is an abridged version of the novel, Lay Your Sleeping Head. You can buy the complete novel at Amazon. For this episode, our cast was Armando Rey as Henry Rios, Douglas Georgas as Grant Hancock, Scarlett Hepworth as Detective Terry Orms, Stuart Slater as Professor Howard, and Sean Gerbo as the nurse. Our director is Russell Kaltschmidt. Our sound engineer is Dave Peck. Music and sound effects were composed by Josh DeRosa. The episode was written and produced by Michael Nava. Thank you for listening.